thank you. So first of all, I wanted to say that it's very strange to have had Valeska here just before me speaking about Beirut, and kind of I'm usually the one talking about the AIF, and having someone kind of speaking about it is nice, and it's kind of a role reversal because I'm now going to speak more about Cologne. I want to thank the organizers for inviting me all the way from Beirut. It's really, as you know, as it was mentioned, I was here in 2012, and it's a pleasure to be back. I'm not sure if it's a good idea to, you know, if it's a good thing to be speaking at the end after all the speakers, but I hope that some of the things that I will address will resonate with what's been said in the last 2 days, and you know, will raise more questions. So in the course of my artistic practice, institutional and personal archives located in Beirut, in Cologne, Düsseldorf, and London, among other places, became the site of my research investigations. And here I understand the term archives in the broad sense of, or the most commonly used sense of, a repository where you have material that has come to belong together through a set of intentional actions, but sometimes also random and accidental actions. Sometimes one archive of the ones that I mentioned led me to another, contradicting the idea that an individual item or a set of related items could easily be determined as belonging primarily to one single place. Mirroring my own trajectories between those cities, the various threads of my explorations interconnected, converged, and diverged again, like some strangely shaped spider web. What also became apparent was that although it may still be relevant to speak about the archive, each of the archives that I inhabited, whether for a few hours or you know for a few months, like in Cologne, was the result of a unique set of decisions and of accidents. And this unique context was therefore something I could not ignore when exploring the contents of each repository. So, archive is place. By looking at the architecture, the organization of those places, one may find certain clues as to the materials held there, how it arrived there, how it is organized. In this sense, an archive can carry with it a certain affect or sensory register, which may impress the visitor in a certain way. So here I'm just showing a few images of archives that I, you know, conducted research in. So this is in London, in Kew. This is the National Art Library at the Victoria and Albert Museum. And of course, I mean, each of them, you know, I call them archives, but each of them is, you know, I think this was mentioned in one of the first talks. But, you know, some of them are actually libraries, some of them are public records office. So, but they all hold, you know, archives. This is in Düsseldorf. I was told it actually moved recently to Duisburg, but this is where I went at the time. So the history, the architecture, the uses, and the transformations of a building can also leave an imprint, even if subtle, on the way individuals navigate and behave when inside its walls. This will no doubt be true for buildings with a past, such as the NS Documentation Center. It may, for instance, be more problematic or difficult to go beyond or to diverge from the factual or the purely historical when interpreting the material present in locations such as the NSDoc. As if the shadows of the past were too heavy to allow for a new or different light to be shed on the material. So in a way dictating the way the material is read by users. And there are two things that I started thinking about when I was visiting those placements and, you know, that have to do with displacement, the notion of displacement. So the first one was the degree of institutionalization of an archive or repository, ranging from a personal or family archive all the way to a private archive and all the way to a local or national one. And then the other thing was the geographical distance from the place of origin of the material or the place described in the material. And this, of course, is something that comes up, you know, strongly in the case of collections that are held in countries that were former colonial powers. So where you have, you know, ethnographic museums. And So if you think as archive as place, you can then think of the movement of, you know, in those places and outside of those places. And this brings me to the second part. So besides thinking about the presence of an archive as the repository and place, one can move into the shell or the structure to focus on the presence of the archival material itself. Here I go back to a specific case involving two different archives that I encountered while researching about the same topic. Of course, this is a specific case and it does not constitute a generality applying to all archival material. In particular, I'm mostly preoccupied with photography, with images, and photographic material, which come with their own, you know, physical, material, and technical specificities. So to give you some context, and this was during my art residency in Cologne here at the end of 2012, I became interested in the figure of Erich Sander, who was the son of the renowned photographer August Sander. And I'm sure most of you know his work, the work that he's most known for, which is People of the 20th Century, mentioned as 20 Jahrhunderts. And here I just want to thank the NS Documentation Center, and in particular Dr. Ulrich Eumann, who was extremely helpful and generous with sharing information. He's conducting research about this topic. So in addition to being a photographer, trained in his father's studio, Erich Sander was a political activist and a local leader of the SAPD. He was imprisoned by the National Socialists in 1934. This is not him, by the way. While in prison, he was asked by the prison officials to carry out photographic assignments within the prison, including ID photographs of his fellow prisoners. So I became interested in this series of ID photos, and the interesting thing was that some of them ended up as portraits in August Sander's work, under the portfolio Political Prisoners in the group The City, which is like the seventh, the sixth volume, if you look at the published edition. And some of them even became part of art collections because, of course, with you know, photography, you can have then limited editions, and the work of August Sander is present in various collections in museums. So this is the kind of a mapping of that portfolio of Political Prisoners in August Sander's work. And you can recognize two of the prisoners from the previous photographs. This is from the Tate website. Here, if you look at the caption, it says that the copyright is still with the Fotografische Sammlung, the SK Stiftung Kultur, which has the August Sander archive. So how did these images taken in a prison end up in a photographic work? What happened, presumably, is that Erich Sander, with the help of others, managed to smuggle certain negatives and prints out to his family, asking them to pass them on to families of his fellow prisoners depicted in the photographs. He even mentions in his letters to his father that certain of the images he was sending could be considered as successful portraits, therefore indicating that he had high technical and even maybe artistic considerations while making those ID photographs within the existing constraints of working in a prison. And so I became very interested in the different diverging intentions contained in the making of those photographs. So, you know, for the purpose of the prison authorities, but at the same time being made by someone who had professional training and who was kind of, in a way, also exchanging with his father about the work of the photographic work that his father was working on. And so I became interested in how those intentions also may have affected the circulation of those photographs in the future. So for me, this divergence of intentions, which could even seem contradictory, would not have been as manifest or as real if I had not realized that the ID photographs belonged to two different archives, themselves created under very different intentions and with very different missions. Just to specify, when I say that the photographs belong to two different archives, I do not imply that the material is exactly the same in those two archives. Rather that an integral body of material created uniquely under a unique set of circumstances then found itself in various places and for various reasons, losing the unity and the integrity under which the material initially came into existence. So in this particular case, you have the negatives relating to the prisoner ID photographs, which are mostly held at the Landesarchiv, so the previous Düsseldorf archive, as part of the prisoner's files. But some of the negatives and prints are also can also be found at the SK Stiftung Kultur, which houses the Augustlander archive. The spread among different places, some more institutional than others, of archival materials that can be traced back to a unique source testifies to leakages which reveal micro-histories about and around the artifacts and the people those artifacts concern. In a metaphorical or an analogic, analogical sense, the negatives are such a physical manifestation of those leakages, having been smuggled or leaked out of the Siegburg prison by the photographer Erich Sander. Those negatives, in one instance, belong to a large repository, the Düsseldorf Archive or the Landesarchiv, only constituting a tiny fragment of the overall records kept there, and only rarely being consulted. In some cases, I could tell that I was the only or the first one to consult the negatives, which were still in the original envelopes in the prisoner's files. So, and the envelopes were sealed. So, and in another instance, they are a core part of their repository at the SK Stiftungskultur, having integrated the corpus of work of Augustlander. This multiple existence is, of course, enabled by the means of technological reproduction and the technical specificities tied to the photographic image and its production. Taking, for example, the negative and its positive, the print, which allow for easier multiplication of the image. There's also a thought that I'd like to throw out, which I won't go into detail, but it's been said that photography, more than any other material, can disrupt an archive, and this is maybe also something to think about here. So the profile of the researcher looking into the SK Stiftung Kultur and the purpose of the investigation will probably be very different from an exploration of the same material at the Düsseldorf Archive. Each archive will inevitably attract primarily a certain type of visitor, for instance, a photographer or an art historian versus a scholar or a war historian. Of course, any thorough and nimble researcher may, without too much difficulty, locate any relevant interconnections and linkages between repositories and move from one to the other, following the leads a bit like a detective or an investigator. Nevertheless, the location of the archive and the mission behind the establishment of any particular repository may to a large extent dictate the future use or non-use of any archival material. These realities struck me in particular when I realized that what I could not access or use from one archive because of the strict guidelines for use and reproduction and copyright issues, among other constraints, was available to me from the other archive. Despite belonging to the same original corpus, the material in each of the two archives had followed very different trajectories. On the one hand, the SK Stiftung Kultur houses the August Sander archive and closely controls the access, the visibility, and the exposure of the collection. Although some of the material, I have to say, it belongs to the family, and so you have the grandson, Julian Sander, who has his gallery in Bonn, and who has the estate of August Sander and the collection, the private collection of Gerd Sander, who's the nephew, I think, of August Sander. And on the other hand, you have the Landesarchiv, which, as its name indicates, holds the documents relating to the geographical region of Nordrhein-Westfalen, and as such, has a very different kind of mission. So as such, the negatives that I was interested in were not being kept there in relation to Augustlander, but were there as part of the prisoner records of men who had been incarcerated by the National Socialists in Zygbuk prison. And to me, it felt like an uncanny stroke of luck to be able to reach the material that I needed, in a way circumventing the SK Stiftungskultur, yet keeping within the applicable terms and conditions, simply because I was operating under the rules of another institution. But beyond the technicalities of use and access, what emerges from such an experience is the possible ubiquitous nature of what is often considered as original and therefore unique material, supposedly existing only in one place at the same time. And this, of course, applies mainly to analog material. You know, I'm not going into digital here at all. So exploring these multiple presences can shed some light on the diverse trajectories and microhistories of the artifacts and the people they concern, as well as reveal the dynamics governing archives. And in a perhaps continuous feedback loop, you could say that the contents of an archive shape its form, but then in return, the form also determines the content. Perhaps it's the role of the user then, the researcher, the historian, the artist, to look and operate through those boundaries and artificial barriers, and to offer the possibility of identifying linkages, reviewing the archival material in a more comprehensive and loose way, which may be closer to the complex and multiple lives of that material. What an artist or any investigator can bring in a unique way is to cast a new surface of appearance, to borrow the expression from Ariella Azoulay, who herself actually borrows it from Michel Foucault. So a surface of appearance may be understood not only as a new reading, but rather as a new intention, as if a new light was cast on the material, allowing the reader to identify certain elements which were not necessarily legible before. In my case, having familiarized myself with the information available from the NS Documentation Center and from the SK Stiftungskultur, I then approached the Landesarchiv in Düsseldorf with a certain intention governed by a unique set of knowledge and of expectations. This intention, once projected onto the research material, would have somehow activated part of the potential carried by the material. And I think yesterday Boris Nisloni spoke of this potential of the archive in a very eloquent way. It is often said that archives have no use until they are utilized or explored. However, it is also obvious that any particular user and usage carries with it a particular set of limitations and constraints. So you can think of the limits of the archive, but then you can think of the limits that are carried with each user of the archive. Any consultation and exploration of whatever archival material involves a degree of interpretation and also of the projection of one's personal expectations onto the archive. And I think Valeska mentioned this when she talked about Akram Zaatari and how he kind of used the images from the Arab Image Foundation. So this may be especially obvious in the case of artists who are more free in their approach and not bound by the necessities of objectivity. After all, it's not far-fetched to say that one finds what one wants to find and one sees what one wants to see. Although not the only one, I will probably be among the few individuals to have consulted the material related to Alexander and the photographs he supposedly took in Zygbuk prison. I will have explored this material in a certain way, and my treatment of it will have been far from that of a historian or a biographer. As such, what ends up surviving from this episode of history will survive partly through the specific and subjective form of my work. Some aspects of the material will have been retained, emphasized, and maybe even exaggerated, while other aspects will remain invisible, unseen, or ignored. In this sense, each and every investigation extends the life and the trajectory of the archival material in a very particular and unique way, contributing simultaneously to the process of survival, but also of erasure of that material and all the histories that it carries with it. If it's possible to speak of archive as presence, it is obviously also possible to think of archive as absence. Without going into the subject, which has been already, well explored, what I will mention is that in places like archives, where it all becomes about the physicality of traces, one becomes all the more aware of the gaps. But in a way, what exists in terms of evidence may enable us to imagine what is missing. And this is arguably a stronger position to be in than not even being able or being aware of what is not there. So in contrast to what is traceable and tangible and to what is clearly missing, it may therefore be possible to imagine an in-between place or space, a gray zone extending from the identifiable archive to its negative, or as in its opposite, and leaving a space for all erased, unofficial, semi-verifiable, and imagined or fictional matter. This gray zone can perhaps typically be considered as the terrain or operation of an artist. In the course of my practice, what has so far been a constant revelation to me was that has been the interconnectedness between the various locations and places I visited and explored during my research. Maybe this is what we call intuition, maybe it's coincidence. But if you want to speak about art residencies, which are becoming much more prevalent or have become more prevalent, they can seem somewhat an artificial arrangement. Sometimes parachuting an artist into a new foreign environment with few markers except the constraints to produce new work. Nevertheless, an artist will bring a set of subjectivities that will shape and inform his or her interaction and mode of operation. As such, connections are in a way bound to be formed or revealed. The creative process is governed by a set of intentions that will determine what information is retained, what is rejected, whether consciously or unconsciously. And this perhaps goes back to the surface of appearance that I referred to earlier. So in addition to a more conscious decision-making process, there are sometimes uncanny coincidences that can reinforce the connections and broaden the constellations. So why is it, for example, that only a few months before traveling to Cologne for the first time, I stumbled across and bought a second-hand book, War and War, by Hungarian writer Laszlo Krasznahorkai. And that this book had a chapter entitled The Thing in Cologne, and that it dealt with archives and the impossible quest for eternal preservation. So I found this book completely by chance before coming, basically. In Krasznahorkai's book, in a passage that touches on the many themes related to what can be called the promise of the archive, the narrator, a certain individual named Korin, who works as an archivist, recounts how he comes across an extraordinary document. And I just wanted to read an excerpt because that work really resonated with me when I came. So back home, so Korin broke the momentous silence that had descended on him. Back home, he used to work in an archive where the day generally ended at about 4:30 or a little earlier. And one day, on one of the back shelves, he found a file that contained a mass of papers that hadn't been disturbed in decades. So having found it, he brought it out to get a better idea of its contents, took it to examine under the big lamp on the main table, opened it up, spread it out, nosed around in it, leafed through it, and investigated the various palliums, intending to put them into order, should they require ordering. When suddenly, while examining various journals, letters, accounts, and copies of wills referring to the Vlasic family, along with other miscellaneous documents the file contained, as he was looking through these, he came upon a pallium registered in the system as number 4/3/10/1941-42, a number he still remembered because it didn't fit, which is to say it didn't fit the family documents category that the Roman numeral 4 indicated in the archive. He sat down to read through it from start to finish, sitting and reading, as he recalled, for hours on end, while the clock in the office moved on, unable to stop reading, until he reached the end, at which point he turned off the lights, closed up the office, went home, and started reading it once more, because there was something about the way the whole thing had fallen into his hands, so to speak, that made him want to reread it straight away, indeed immediately. because it took no more than the first three sentences to convince him that he was in the presence of an extraordinary document, something so out of the ordinary, that he would go so far as to say that it, that is to say, the work that had come into his possession, was a work of astonishing, foundation-shaking, cosmic genius. And thinking so, he continued to read and reread the sentences till dawn and beyond. And no sooner had the sun risen, but it was dark again, about 6 in the evening, and he knew, absolutely knew, that he had to do something about the vast thoughts forming in his head, thoughts that involved making major decisions about life and death, about not returning the manuscript to the archive, but ensuring its immortality in some appropriate place. And from that day on, he declared, he began to study the various repositories, if he might put it so, of eternal truth, so that he might discover what historical methods had been employed for the preservation of sacred messages, of visions, if you like, concerning one's first steps onto the road of eternal truth. So as with Krasznahorkai's narrator, Corinne, it would not seem too far-fetched to believe that a particular archival item finds the artist, rather than the artist finding it. In this sense, leakages out of the archive through artistic production or fictional writing can appear as rescue situations, in which case the archive is not seen as a safekeeping repository, but rather as a dump of history. An artist, or to some extent a researcher, will gather material in the course of his research. And although I would not go so far as to say that it always, you know, or an artist's work always undermines or disturbs the archive, it would be legitimate to suggest that an artist dealing with archives in his work will create an in-between space in which archives, whether public or private, formal or informal, can collide. And the work becomes a site of such collisions and of temporal and spatial collapse. Thank you. That's all.